Alfredo Granados Olivas has a farm in Chihuahua, Mexico, about a 30-minute drive south of the border with New Mexico. And today he's sitting at the head of a kitchen table on that farm.
And here are the plates for the salad.
He's gathered about 20 people. They're researchers, students, and family members, and they're all sharing pork, rice, and beans that his wife made. The area around his house is mostly farmland, and that's actually becoming less and less true.
And that's because a lot of the fields are abandoned. They don't have vegetation. Natural vegetation is gone already because they pull them out to pull the crops.
The water hidden deep under our feet at his farm is shared with his community. That includes small farmers with limited resources and big companies alike. It also crosses the border, and it's getting smaller. Granados' colleague Rafael Corral Diaz says the ongoing drought is putting pressure on this resource that's regulated in different ways by different governments.
We know one thing for sure. Traditional agriculture is not solving the problem right now. So that's why people are abandoning places because they don't have the resources. They require a lot of water to produce a pound of food, for example, or a pound of meat.
Granados says the best way to manage the source is for everyone to use less of it. So he works with the people around this table to bring AI, drones, and other tech to the edge of the Chihuahuan desert and keep the farmers there afloat. But they're still working on convincing the farmers it works and big investors and collaborators that this is the future of keeping fresh produce on the grocery shelves. I'm Megan Myskowski, and this is Tapped, a podcast where we tell our stories, the stories of people living with the cost of drought in the Southwest and what we can do to mitigate it. On this episode, the U.S.-Mexico border crosses a lot of aquifers, and there's no one way it's regulated. In fact, there are a lot of ways. It can change from state to state, town to town, aquifer to aquifer. And that's getting more complicated as the region gets drier. And this time, I'm going to have some help telling the story. Hi, Chantal.
Hi, Megan.
Tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
I'm Chantal Kauf-Schultz, and I'm a science writer for the Texas Water Resources Institute. That basically means that I write about any major water issues in Texas. Bad water quality, I cover it. Too little water, I cover it. Too much water? Yeah, I cover that too.
So what's been top of mind for you lately?
I've been thinking a lot about transboundary aquifers. That means groundwater that's shared across borders. Groundwater doesn't pay attention to political boundaries, so a whole lot of people can all be pulling from the same aquifer without having a good strategy for not using it up too fast. And that's happening all over the world.
So that's happening here in Arizona and also in Texas where you are, right?
Yep, exactly.
So Chantal and I went to see what that looks like together in person on a ranch in Chihuahua, a couple hours away from El Paso and Juarez. We drove down along the border wall and crossed about a half hour north of the farm.
It's a dusty ride down, but once you get onto the farm itself, it's pretty green. So there's a pond where carp will soon be swimming and all these rows of little baby pecan trees. And you can see mountains in just about any direction you look.
Alfredo Granados Olivas owns the farm, and he's a longtime professor at the Universidad Autónoma de Ciudad Juárez. He told us about how he got there.
Granados knew he wanted to be on a farm as a kid.
But my parents didn't have any land for me.
He went to school to be an agricultural engineer. He thought he'd get onto a farm that way. And people had told him it was a solid career choice.
All the way until 1982 when the oil crisis came in. So all the jobs got shut down in 82, and I was in the middle of the university and the career.
He traveled around looking for work, and he found nothing.
So I came back, how do you say that, derrotado?
Defeated.
Defeated. I came back defeated from that field trip. I drink a lot of beer with my friends, I can tell you that.
He found a job at an air conditioning repair shop and did that for a while. It wasn't farming, but it paid the bills.
So after 6 months, I was... The guy told me, the owner of the shop, aren't you a professional agriculture engineer? Yes, I am. But I have no friends and no political power, didn't get a job because of the crisis. You should do something with your career, your life. That's what he told me.
So he went back to school. He found a scholarship for a master's program in groundwater hydrology, and he got it.
When I got married with Teresa and started working here.
By here, he means the farm next door. His in-laws lived there, and they let him put his 2 degrees to work on their irrigation system. And next door, they had a neighbor who'd made a lot of money in the U.S. and bought a farm. So when Granados was done in the afternoons...
I came and he was waiting with a cup of coffee.
He says the neighbor, despite resistance from his family, abandoned the farm and gave it over to Granados. He named the farm El Regalo, the gift.
We go to his pump house, where he has a relatively new, efficient electric pump. Things have changed over the 30 plus years he's been here. It's gotten drier, and big operations on both sides of the border have spent a lot of money drilling deep.
The new corporations that are coming in here, they bring their drillers, brand new drilling rigs, and they can go as deep as 350 meters, and then you will hit the regional aquifer.
That's over 1,000 feet. And when they go deeper than the smaller farmers here and overpump, the smaller farmers' wells go dry, so they can't farm anything. Granados says that sends many people, climate refugees, over the border looking for work. Granados is a full-time researcher, and this farm ultimately is a research center. He's trying to keep small farmers here by giving them tools, services, and knowledge that'll help them use less water. So this farm is a proving ground as well as a place to show farmers those new techniques and technology. We're standing in a pecan grove just outside the pump house, and the dirt has a crisscross pattern laid into it.
So what we do is run that straight lines like that and straight lines like that, north, south, east to west, as close as possible to the tree.
He says that keeps precipitation on his field, which is sloped, but doesn't stop the necessary runoff. The trees are young, and each has a perfect circle of wet dirt around it, making a polka-dotted pattern on the field.
That's exactly what I want. And this irrigation started at 7 p.m. last night. I can shut it down right now because I went all the way to 45 centimeters. You can see that? That's enough. So 12 hours of irrigation, that's enough for me in this field.
Farmers here would normally flood irrigate a pecan grove like this, but he's injecting the water directly where the trees need it, and doing it at a time when the heat and sun won't burn it off.
He also has a team of researchers and students, the ones who were at his kitchen table earlier. He works with them to bring new technology to farms here. One of their main goals is putting tech in reach of farmers by making it affordable. One example, he brought on a student who flies a drone that collects crop data. That student is working on breaking down the drone so he can learn how it works and make his own. The new one will be tailored to the needs of these farmers, and it'll be cheaper, because cost is a huge barrier to using those here.
So it's not that the idea that each farmer has to buy a drone, because it's not efficient, but it's the idea to form 5-6 students that are expert.
And those students could work with the farmers.
So these guys can go over there and sell the services. So as we have more drones, we will require more specially trained people.
And he says the students can provide another service that other drone operators here don't. They analyze the information before handing it over, so farmers know what they're looking at. Still, he says he's looking for more support from investors, involvement from researchers, and help from the government to make this a more serviceable project.
We wish we had the government in here investing money in this type of projects, or to reduce the cost of electricity, or to pay some of this investment by some programs that they used to have in the past. But we haven't had that.
So what is an aquifer? That water under Granado's farm that spans across the border.
An aquifer is a sponge.
That's Rosario Sanchez. She researches transboundary water issues at the Texas Water Resources Institute. She's Chantal's colleague, too.
It can be different types of sponge, right, that holds water to be used in the future or in the present. And it's been stored there for either a couple of years, hundreds of years, or millions of years. It depends on the sponge and the type of sponge.
The border between the U.S. and Mexico crosses over many aquifers, just like it cuts across rivers, basins, and communities. And there's no one approach to dealing with it. Mexico manages water at the federal level, but the U.S. mostly leaves it to individual states to regulate. And even within the states, you might have areas where it's handled differently from others, like in Arizona, where some communities have well-defined rules about who can drill water and some have virtually none.
It's very local, it's very attached to the community. So because of the geography and how groundwater behaves. So really, at the federal or macro level, it's hard and there is none, actually, communication on groundwater.
There are other factors that can decide how much people work across the border on this. If there are densely populated areas next to each other on the border, that means they're more likely to communicate. And some places stand out as having more success on that.
Arizona and Sonora, because I don't think it's Arizona, Mexico, it's Arizona and Sonora. Very localized. They have a history of communication and collaboration in other and much other topics besides water.
The Arizona-Mexico Commission is a partnership between the two that's worked together on trade, tourism, and environmental issues for decades.
Water was just another obvious, you know, topic on the table.
But that's unique to there.
You cannot translate that same level of effectiveness or success to Mexico and Texas, for example. It's not at all. And again, I assume that because there's a totally different history between Texas. We had a war. We cannot get over it. There is resentment. There is a powerful economic rich economy as Texas is compared to Mexico.
And even that can vary from place to place along the Texas-Mexico border. Whatever the feelings, people on both sides of the line agree that the water stored underground is a safer bet than what's up top.
Population is growing and surface water is declining due to climate change.
And when you're sharing a resource so vital to life and to income and even survival, it's bound to seep into other issues.
Issues of immigration, issues of national security come into place, issues of sovereignty, issues of international water law, and all those principles that govern the relationships between countries have a say on this.
We have mountains surrounding us. The Franklin Mountains run right through the center of El Paso. It's kind of like a spine of El Paso. And on one side,
that's Scott Reinert. He's the water resources manager at El Paso Water Utilities. I rode along with him to learn more about the water that El Paso and Juarez share.
And I like to tell people, anytime you see mountains, those are the edges of our aquifers. And in between the mountains, you have the sand, silts, and clays for thousands of feet, and that's where our aquifers are. Those are mountains up north. Those are the Oregon Mountains, which are in New Mexico, and those are yet another boundary to the aquifer. And if you could just keep going up straight, you have the Oregon Mountains.
We stop at a golf course where he often eats with his coworkers because it's quiet and he likes the food. El Paso has nearly 700,000 people and Juarez has over twice that. That means they both pump a lot of water from the Waco Bolson aquifer, and pumping at a well pulls more water towards the well.
But as the city grows, we can't simply pump the Waco more and more and more. And that's what we were doing in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. That was our only strategy.
So they had to find a broader variety of sources, not just the same wells. Part of the diversified water portfolio is river water, and part of it is desalinated water from the salty edges of the aquifer. El Paso also uses reclaimed wastewater that's been treated all the way up to irrigation standards. And in the future, they'll also be using what's called purified water, or wastewater that's been treated all the way up to drinking water standards. And Reinert says for him, good communication over the border is better than more regulation on how to share the water.
They have smart people on their side of the border, and we have smart people here. and understanding that they want to manage their aquifer in their way and make it sustainable. They're smart enough to do what it needs to be to make it sustainable.
And he says one of the best tools they've had for doing that is a data sharing project. The U.S. Geological Survey made a model of the shared groundwater here with the help of El Paso, Juarez, and others. That model set off an international data sharing relationship. And they still use it to share information across the border on pumping levels, new wells, water quality, and more.
And I'd like to say that both countries felt very proud about the sharing of data. And we share technical ideas. We don't try to regulate or control what they do, but if, when they have questions about technical concepts, I think there is also good concept or technical sharing of ideas.
The data sharing relationship is just that, data sharing. They don't co-manage the aquifers.
I've always felt that if we want something from Mexico, they will give it to us, provided that we share our data. It doesn't work when we ask them for their stuff and we don't give them. So we try to, and I think both countries really respect that.
And they've used it to pull off some big projects.
Yes, I think the model played an important role on the building of our desalination plant. It helped us understand where the best location was strategically in the aquifer for brackish water, fresh water, movement of groundwater coming into the town.
He says the data sharing relationship is going to be vital for planning for the future, as both sides of the border will have to decide how to get enough water.
The future of the Waco-Wilson and its management is more and more desalting. And Mexico doesn't desalt, not yet, but at some point, perhaps they will, because I think Mexico has similar numbers, this much fresh, three times as much brackish. I just think that has to be at least in the dialogue for future water for both sides.
Further west, there's a pair of towns at the border between Arizona and Sonora with the same name, Nogales. Nogales, Sonora is an industrial city of 250,000 people, and Nogales, Arizona is a much quieter town of just 20,000.
I'm the public works director for the city of Nogales.
That's Alejandro Barcenas.
I've been in this job for 10 years now. In my past life, I worked for the State Department of Water Resources.
Barcenas lives and works in Nogales, Arizona.
We share the water with Mexico, different country, different regulations, different economic situation, different population.
They share the Santa Cruz Aquifer and the Santa Cruz River, which actually crosses into Mexico and then comes back. He says the aquifers here are dependent on the rains and the flooding of the river. And they're shallow, much shallower than in Tucson, for example, about 40 miles north. They also share a wash with Nogales, Sonora that brings trash and contaminants over when a big rain comes. When that happens, Barcenas and his team reach directly out to their counterparts over the border.
Those are communications that are almost on a daily basis, that we notify them. We see this is coming in, we see, and they try to address that as soon as possible. The real issue is the communication. We're not supposed to have direct communication with a foreign country.
Arizona and Sonora might have some of the strongest communication along the border, but it can still feel a little too bureaucratic when there's an emergency playing out that requires people on both sides of the border to coordinate and move fast. And even when things aren't urgent, he says it can be hard to go through the normal channels with the federal government when necessary.
We're a small fish in this situation, so that's why probably the attention that we're going to receive at the federal level is going to be totally different than the attention that El Paso or San Diego or that area there, San Diego, Tijuana.
The size difference between Nogales, Arizona and Nogales, Sonora also matters. Nogales, Sonora is a much more industrial town. So a lot of industrial metals come over from Mexico. And the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality requires Nogales, Arizona to clean them up. And it's not cheap to do that. The city, and so the taxpayers, have to pay for it.
And we're not against that. We are for protecting the environment. But also we're put in a situation that normally no city of this size would have to go through.
Another defining feature of the city is that the commercial area butts up right against the border wall, and Border Patrol has a large presence. He says the Border Patrol put in grates to prevent people from crossing through the wash a few years ago.
Those grates were supposed to open when the big flood event came. That didn't happen, so they created a dam underground and created a big flood in Mexico, and that flood crossed the border and created a big flood in this side of the border, too.
The town gets a lot of traffic during the day, too. About 30,000 to 40,000 people cross the border every day, and not all of them spend time in Nogales, but a significant number do.
And that's a blessing and a curse to us, because the blessing is because we get business, we get people to buy stuff here. That's a blessing. But also on the water consumption, there are people that come and do laundry here. They come and to do the car washes, because the situation on water in Mexico is totally different.
Water's more reliable on this side, so they ultimately provide even drinking water to people who live just over the border. So Chantal, we did a lot of reporting. What was your takeaway?
From everyone we talked to, no one said both countries' governments co-regulating transboundary aquifers is likely to happen anytime soon. And not everyone even agreed that it would be a good solution.
What they say would be better?
From what people told us, the future is going to look a lot like what's already happening, but more so. Scientists talking with each other, community leaders and utilities talking with each other, and everybody else also keeping those conversations running. It's going to be up to everybody using the limited water resources to get a basic understanding of what's actually going on. That's why people like Granados are teaching people those basics.
You know, I think Rosario Sanchez actually had something to say about that.
That's why this science diplomacy trend or concept is gaining more traction. Like, hey guys, it's not enough that you are a scientist. You need to start communicating more efficiently to us, the diplomats or the decision makers, to make things work on the other side.
Chantal, this was really fun to work on with you. Thanks for stepping in and doing it.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, this was just such a joy to learn about together.
On the next episode, the last episode in the series, Arizona is one of the fastest growing states in the country, even while water here is becoming scarce.
We think the West is this place where you can be a rugged individualist and you can buy a plot of land and eke out a hard scrabble living all on your own. And it's absolute mythology. It is not true.
Can the state keep providing enough water as new people come and homes are built? And if it doesn't, what'll that do to the economy? This episode of Tapped was co-reported, written, and hosted by me, Megan Myskowski, and Chantal Koff Schultz of the Texas Water Resources Institute. Duncan Moon is our editor. Christopher Conover is our news director at AZPM. Zach Ziegler is our production engineer, and JT Thorpe is our fact checker. The music you're listening to is by Michael Greenwald. If you want to see Chantal's pictures, some links, and other things, you can go to our website at azpm.org/tapped.
This episode of Tapped was supported by a grant from The Water Desk, an independent journalism initiative based at the University of Colorado Boulder's Center for Environmental Journalism.